Hello and welcome to this edition of Viewpoints on today's show. Six Nations and First Nations from across Ontario have approved a $8.5 billion Ontario Child and Family Services Reform Agreement.
This would not be possible without each and every one of you, your support. These are extremely important. These are tools that we need to continue to advance, work with one another, support one another.
Sackville resident Emily McBride has been fighting for the right to build a small rectangular-shaped home, and she won her case.
The process is done. Feeling really good about it. I've been waiting for this since October, and I will be at the Planning Commission's office in the morning with my building permit application, so that feels really good.
The third annual Cape Breton Music Industry Hall of Fame inductees are announced.
Music is for everybody, so come enjoy yourselves. Last year, we had over 80 performers on stage. It's the biggest locally produced stage that this island has seen and probably will see, and it'll be a show to remember.
And a rare railway horn was stolen from the Prince George Railway and Forestry Museum, a piece of history lost forever.
We do sound them every once in a while and blame them on our neighbor here across the tracks. But, it's a pretty big thrill when you get a chance to, like, grab that horn, that cord, and give a good blast on the horn. You can actually, with some of the older horns, you can actually play the horn.
Welcome to Viewpoints, local news nationwide.
On the air with Viewpoints. Listen to all our stories on frequencynews.ca.
Hello and thanks for being with us again this week. My name is Boris Chassaigne and we'll be with you for the next half hour and in the company of our national correspondents. Ontario First Nations voted to approve the long-term reform of the First Nations Child and Family Services Agreement on February 26. 76 of the province's 133 First Nations voted in favor of the agreement worth $8.5 billion over 9 years, beginning in 2025-26. This after a national agreement worth $47.8 billion was rejected by the Assembly of First Nations in October of 24. Ontario Regional Chief Abraham Benedict spoke about why the national agreement failed to move forward last fall and of his commitment to finding a solution for the Ontario region's First Nations communities. Details with Andrew Dow in Oshweekend, Ontario.
Chief Benedict spoke on his commitment to the Ontario region and its First Nations communities and the necessity to have an agreement in place based on its diversity.
Today's an important day, but today is not about an individual. This is about our collective efforts in this region to advance the priorities that you have set out for us, that you have said to us that we need to stop the discrimination in our region. We need to bring the resources to our communities. We need to enhance our jurisdiction. We need to be able to support our families today. We can't wait for a national agreement. It's too important in our communities. Ontario is too diverse. I want to acknowledge each and every one of you for the work that you have done, the mandate that you've given us. I want to acknowledge our leadership council and the work that they have done. Grand Chief Abram continues to be there day in day at the negotiations. This would not be possible without each and every one of you, your support. We do not operate without your endorsement and your support. And that is the work that you have set out for us to do to improve the services, to better the lives in your communities. Yes, there's a lot of work to do, but I believe that today is a very momentous moment. Not only are we stopping the discrimination in our communities, in your communities, we're advancing your jurisdiction. We're creating more tools to advance your nationhoods. We've heard a lot about the laws. These are extremely important. These are tools that we need to continue to advance, work with one another, support one another, because Ontario is a very unique region, very diverse region, but is one of the most progressive regions. And that's because of each and every one of you, the commitment that you make to your children, to your families, to the unborn, and so that we can continue to work together to ensure that we're doing the best that we can.
He explained the next steps for the agreement to be settled, which includes it being brought before the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal for approval before March 31st, 2026.
Our next steps will be to go with the process. Yes, there will be a bit more work to do, but I will continue to advocate and continue to advance our position and what you have in the course of action that you have set out for us. And so over the next couple months, we'll continue to update you. We'll continue to keep you informed. I know that we've started the weekly meetings. That was to ensure that we're being transparent and accountable, but also being available to you to ask questions. so that you understand what is happening, what that agreement looks like, what it's shaping up to be. And our team at the Chiefs of Ontario, led by the social unit and our legal team, have been working very hard to ensure that we're meeting your needs, doing the best that we can. 133 First Nations across this region are very diverse. We will not always get to 100% consensus, but we're building upon the important work that we're doing, the instructions that have been given to each and every one of us in this room to protect our children.
Six Nations elected Chief Sherry Lynn Hill made a statement on the agreement during the February 28th Chief and Council radio show, speaking on Six Nations elected Council supporting the deal and its approval.
On February 26th, I participated in Chiefs of Ontario meeting regarding the long-term reform of the First Nations Child and Family Services Program final agreement, where Six Nations elected Council did vote in favor. Ontario Chiefs came together for Wednesday's historic signing, approving the Ontario Final Agreement, committing Indigenous Services Canada to provide $8.5 billion over 9 fiscal years. This was only step one in the process. Next step will see Chiefs of Ontario, Anishinaabe Aski Nation, and Canada to file a joint motion with Canadian Human Rights Tribunal to seek its approval of the agreement and the end of its oversight over the First Nations Child and Family Services Program in Ontario. There is still work to be done, but this is a start.
Patty Hadu, Minister of Indigenous Services Canada, who was also in attendance at the February 26th Chiefs of Ontario Special Chiefs Assembly, spoke on the agreement and what it means for First Nations communities across Ontario.
And we're here today because every child does have the right to feel connected to community, to language, to culture, to feel safe, to wake up in the morning and know that they have value and purpose. And maybe they don't know what they're going to do yet with their lives, but what they do is just as important as everyone else. And that's what this agreement today signifies. That a whole new generation of children are not going to have to go through what many, many of you have gone through and many, many of your loved ones have gone through. So Miigwech for trusting me and for including me in so many communities across Ontario.
I'm Andrew Dow, and this new story is brought to you by the Local Journalism Initiative, which supports the creation of original civic journalism.
Hello, I'm Candace Vetter in Embrim, Ontario, and you're tuned into Viewpoints.
We move to New Brunswick, where the Tetramar Council approved the third and final reading of a planning bylaw change that will allow Emily McBride to install a rectangular-shaped pre-built cedar home on her Sackville property. After a months-long process, the council changed the minimum 20 feet by 20 feet dwelling size rule to a 400 square feet area minimum of any shape. The old rule was likely an aesthetic choice by former councils to prohibit homes that look like mobile homes from being built outside of mobile homes parks. More with Erica Butler.
Emily McBride was celebrating yesterday afternoon after watching Tetramar Council approve the third and final reading of a planning bylaw change that will allow her to install a pre-built cedar home on her Sackville property. Up until yesterday, homes in the former town of Sackville had to be at least 20 feet by 20 feet in dimensions, a restriction that prevented McBride from being able to get a building permit for the 14 by 36 foot cedar home she had selected from a Memram Cook builder. Plan 360 planner Jenna Stewart explained to council in October that the rule was likely an aesthetic choice by former councils to prohibit homes that looked like mobile homes from being built outside mobile home parks. But as of Thursday, the planning rule has been changed. The minimum dwelling size limit is now 400 square feet, and that area can come in any shape.
The process is done. I'm feeling really good about it. I've been waiting for this since October, and I will be at the Planning Commission's office in the morning with my building permit application. So that feels really good. I called the Planning Commission and they said that there will still be a couple weeks wait to actually register the bylaw change. But apart from that, hopefully it should be sailing.
And I mean, every day counts for you at this point, right? I mean, you're waiting with bated breath to get this house installed and set up and built and everything.
I'm glad this got pushed earlier. I was expecting the meeting to be in mid-March, so this is a pleasant surprise. It's helping my housing situation, but I'm also really glad that it can help other folks also with housing solutions, and people can live in smaller homes or less conventional sized homes. So that's a win-win.
Tell me a bit about this home that you will, you know, have coming to your property. It's being built by a company in Memramcook.
Yeah, DR Cedars. They're originally a cedar sawmill. They've started manufacturing two models of homes. One's about 350 square feet and the other one's 500 square feet. And I've chosen the latter. And they've been really great to deal with. And they're in the next community over from where I'm living. And it just made a lot of sense. But obviously, the both of their models didn't fit the Tanchmar bylaw, the dimensional bylaw, but now they can. That's hopefully a good business decision for them, too, that they can make these homes and provide homes for Tanchmar as well.
You had to be patient and persevere with this.
Yeah, it was definitely a test of patience. And I just, after one point, I just had to just accept it as it is and not try to push the process because it's going to take the time it needs. Yeah, today feels pretty great. And I hope that the next steps in my housing project go smoothly as well. I just hope that this bylaw can really help folks looking for smaller homes to live in.
That's Emily McBride, one of the forces behind a bylaw change that removed a dimensional restriction on single-family homes that had prohibited rectangular pre-built homes in the former town of Sackville. CHMA caught up with Tanchmar Mayor Andrew Black after Thursday's council meeting and asked him about the significance of the bylaw change.
I think it's hugely important, and I'm really happy that it passed. It passed without any comment. So I think it's pretty telling that council is in support of seeing innovation, at least from a bylaw perspective, in addressing the housing issues here in Tanchmar.
We had a housing session here in Sackville not too long ago, and you're on the mayor's round. You struck the mayor's roundtable on housing. Are there other, you know, bylaw changes or other initiatives in the works? What else is coming down the pipeline?
Well, I mean, the only thing I can say is that we were talking about the additional dwelling units. So what that looks like, because currently it's attached to a dwelling and there's kind of restrictions around it that seem prohibitive to addressing housing concerns. I can't say exactly what's coming down the pipe yet, only because the Mayor's Roundtable will be meeting next week to analyze a lot of the data that came out of that housing session. So hopefully we can pull stuff out of there that will be presented to council or come before council to address some of those concerns.
One of the things that was mentioned during that session is this idea of the municipality jumping on opportunities in infrastructure funding from the province and from the federal government. That seems like there's no time to kind of waste on those items. So what's the story there?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I think a lot of the conversation around that is tied to specific projects. Not that it has to be that way, because I know, for example, Moncton accessed the HAF funding, so the Housing Accelerator Fund, for sort of just this generic pot of money that they can then use for housing initiatives. Obviously, proving that through the funding reporting after the fact. Our concept here in Tanchmar is that it has to be project specific, but again, those conversations will happen with the mayor's roundtable, potentially with the recommendation to council and staff.
Okay. No funding bodies have been approached yet on infrastructure for housing.
At this point, no. You know, there's always the opportunity for something in the works. I mean, we do have nonprofit organizations such as Fresh Winds that is looking at building their project on Fairfield Road. So if there's an opportunity there to access funding either through the federal or provincial government, then we, as a municipality, I feel that we'll look at that.
That's Tanchmar Mayor Andrew Black.
That was Erica Butler in Sackville, New Brunswick.
Questions or comments? Our email is radio@frequencynews.ca. Radio@frequencynews.ca.
This year's Cape Breton Music Industry Hall of Fame inductees have been revealed. Sydney's Cape Breton Music Industry Cooperative announced the names of its new Hall of Famers: singer-songwriter Bruce Guthrow, the Rankin Family Group, and Donnie Campbell, a host of Cape Breton's longest-running Celtic radio program, the Celtic Serenade, will be honored at the third annual Hall of Fame Gala, Jacob Postlewaite, in Glace Bay, Nova Scotia.
A round of Cape Breton folk tunes rang in the reveal of this year's Cape Breton Music Industry Hall of Fame inductees. Sydney's McDonald Nissan hosted the Cape Breton Music Industry Cooperative to announce which Cape Breton music legends would be inducted into the Hall of Fame this year. Singer-songwriter Bruce Guthrow, musical family group The Rankin Family, and Donnie Campbell, host of Cape Breton's longest-running Celtic radio program Celtic Serenade, will be honored at the third annual Hall of Fame Gala. Bruce Guthrow passed away in 2023, and his induction was announced by board director of the Cape Breton Music Industry Cooperative, Debbie Mullins, who paid respect to Guthrow's legacy.
Over a career spanning more than four decades, Guthrow captivated audiences with his compelling storytelling and emotive voice. Bruce Guthrow released several solo albums that showcase his versatility across genres, blending folk, country, Celtic influences.
The next inductees were announced by Aaron Lewis, board member of the Cape Breton Music Industry Cooperative and chair of the Hall of Fame Committee. He spoke about the Rankin family's history. The third and final inductee for this year's entry into the Hall of Fame was announced by Cape Breton Music Industry Cooperative Vice Chair Nigel Kearns. He talked about Donnie Campbell's contributions to folk and Celtic music. The announcement of the inductees was followed by the announcement of a raffle contest to help raise money for the cooperative and the Hall of Fame. The gala and concert for the Hall of Fame celebration will be on June 19th at the Centre 200 Arena. The gala is put on by the Cape Breton Music Industry Cooperative, a nonprofit organization developed to grow and support Cape Breton's music industry. Chair of the board of directors of the cooperative, Mark Bott, says the event honors Cape Breton's musical heritage.
Music is for everybody, so come enjoy yourselves. Last year we had over 80 performers on stage. It's the biggest locally produced stage that this island has seen and probably will see, and it'll be a show to remember.
He says the gala and concert is the cooperative's most exciting day of the year. Previous inductees to the Hall of Fame are Rita McNeil, the Men of the Deeps, Matt Minglewood, and Buddy McDonald's song Getting Dark Again in 2023. Then John Allen Cameron, Winston Scotty Fitzgerald, and Joella Folds in 2024. After this year's inductees were announced, those attending were treated to more traditional Cape Breton folk music from Aaron Lewis and fellow musicians Sean and Jim McDonald. I'm Jacob Postlewaite.
Anastasia Avakumova in beautiful British Columbia, and you are tuned to Viewpoints.
And we'll close this episode of Viewpoints out west, where a rare sand-casted Nathan M5 Ayrshime train horn was stolen from the Prince George Railway and Forestry Museum on the night of February 22nd. It is said to be worth around $6,000. While theft is rare at the sprawling 8.5-acre site, this marks the fourth vintage horn stolen from the museum. Park manager Brian Witcher recalls his youth listening to the sounds of these horns ringing off the walls of the Pemberton Valley. Journalist Ian Gregg in Prince George, British Columbia, was up for the ride.
Prince George residents can identify a familiar sound scraping through the air multiple times a day in our community as trains clack across a landscape and horns blast their alert on the edge of town. Similar sounds have been present since the early 1900s here in Claidley-Tenay territory. Commemorating that industrial heritage is a railway and forestry museum on River Road. While we're aware that their collection of machines and artifacts have historical value, we may not always be cognizant of the hard cash value some of these items carry. Our community was bluntly reminded of this fact on the night of Saturday, February 22nd, when a vintage Nathan M5 Ayrshime railway horn was stolen from the property. Park manager Brian Veek gave us a closer look at the sleeping giant an RS-10 diesel electric hybrid locomotive circa the early 1950s, minus one specific component.
Within the horns, there's a series of chimes, some of which are reversible, and there's bells within the horn itself.
That's right. On the back of each flute, there's a sort of a little disc, and as you pass air over the disc, it vibrates at a certain frequency.
What was the model of the horn that was stolen?
I'm not an expert on horns, but a fella in Vancouver Island was actually the one that developed the Nathan horn, and that became the standard across North America.
Really?
Yeah. So, oh. Yeah, another local thing. You'd never guess that something like that would be developed right here in BC. So this was a M5 air chime. There's several similar models that later, I think it was the K5LA that was on this locomotive that got stolen last year, the 6001 electric.
Wow.
That's another victim of our copper thieves. So
I bet you there'd be an incredible
amount of copper.
There
was wire between each one of these insulators on the roof.
Right.
And that's all been cut off by the copper thieves and everything.
What? I was about to ask, my impression is that the Railway and Forestry Museum doesn't experience theft very often, but this actually isn't the first time a horn has been stolen.
Actually, it started last year. Four horns are now missing. And yeah, I know, it's really sad, because I mean, the whole museum is started by volunteers, supported by volunteers and generous donations by the public, local companies and corporations and everything. It's one of the reasons people love living here. And you know, you always hear so much negative stuff about Prince George, but then you look past a few blemishes that we have, and Prince George is such an awesome place. The people I meet here are spectacular. Yeah, it's just, like I said, it's, in polite company, disappointing when you see something like this happen.
Yeah.
Thefts are quite rare here. I mean, we do have an upgraded security system here. There's only so much you can do with some of the artifacts that are on the outside.
Yeah.
We're always improving, though, so
right.
that makes it a little better, but yeah.
It's an exterior museum. You walk throughout these hulking relics of the past that represent so much about a provincial history. You can't contain them inside a building. The expense of that would be, well, astronomical, I'm sure.
Well, that's something we're always working on.
Right.
And I mean, you know, in the ideal world, we'd have all kinds of indoor spaces. And eventually, we're aiming for that.
Yeah.
So it'll come. Yeah, 8.5 acres that we have here. Usually the tool I need is 8.5 acres away from where it's needed. So that's what keeps us busy here. The thefts here are very rare.
Yeah.
And when they come along, it's always a shock and a big disappointment that you see, you know, something like, you know, the train horn here. We do sound them every once in a while and blame them on our neighbor here across the tracks. But, it's a pretty big thrill when you get a chance to, like, grab that horn, that cord, and give a good blast on the horn. You can actually, with some of the older horns, you can actually play the horn, you know, whereas modern locomotives, you press a button and it honks. These things here, when you feather the valves off, you can do some pretty neat stuff with them. So
it's a perk of employment around here.
It definitely is.
All right, do you want to take a look at this unit?
I guess this is an RS-10, and one of only two left in existence.
Wow.
And this is a diesel electric here. And the
diesel electric?
Yeah, so just like a modern locomotive, you've got a big diesel engine that runs a generator, and then the generator creates electricity that drives the, in this case, four traction motors underneath. It's not like you can just pop a clutch on one of these things and pull a mile-long train. Using the electric motors to pull the train is a lot more practical. And this one was actually stored serviceable. So when BC Rail donated it to the museum, they did a lot of great work to stabilize the unit, and basically just needs a really good amount of work to get the paint restored on it, and it would be a great piece. We actually had an ex-BC Rail employee come by and show us how to start it up and the maintenance we need to do on it every year to keep it up mechanically.
Wow.
So yeah, it's very cool.
Yeah. You can almost drive this train engine out of here.
Yeah. You literally could, because we're actually, every track that you see in the museum here is connected to every other track through the turntable and to the outside world. So
did you ever have a chance to blast some air through the horn that was stolen before it went missing?
Not this particular one, unfortunately. It just breaks my heart because it is a really neat horn. Right behind us here, we have a three-chime horn, a J3, that we regularly put some air in there. And like I said, blame it on our neighbors, and we're hooting and tooting over here having some fun. So.
Normally, this horn is on top of this locomotive.
Yeah.
I would imagine you don't climb on top of every single locomotive every day. How did you notice that this particular horn was missing?
In this particular case, we actually got a warning ahead of time that something might be happening. A fella in Texas actually saw on a Discord server a picture of our horn. So it was probably taken when the other horns were stolen. He phoned a collector in Vancouver who immediately phoned us and said, you got to get up there and do something because your horn is extremely rare and could be a target. So we immediately got our shovel out and climbed up there because there was a pile of snow on there. Right. And so the bolts were frozen. So we put some lubricant on there, try and loosen it up, and we were going to come back the next day and break it off with a breaker bar. And unfortunately, when we came back the next day, it was gone already.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
It's just that fast. You know, it's, you know, there's a lot of legitimate collectors out there, and they hate to see this kind of thing too, you know. And it usually, you know, somebody will come along, snag one of these things, and it's never seen again. So and it can never be shared with anybody. And like I said, the sound from this horn is pretty cool. It's pretty cool. I mean, I used to live in the Pemberton Valley when I was a kid, and you could always hear those five chimers echoing off the valley walls as they come in there. So there's quite a bit of nostalgia attached to a lot of these things as well. So
yeah, the locomotive we're standing right beside, an electric one, also yep. had its horn
that's
stolen.
One of the iconic pieces at the park here, the big electric locomotive. It's on all our brochures. Everybody knows that we have this locomotive, so it's a big attraction, and it's really cool. So unfortunately, of course, that can attract the wrong kind of attention as well. And so, you know, thanks to some of the exposure we've gotten on the internet, unfortunately exposes us to new perils that we really didn't expect. Yeah. So unfortunately, now the rest of the horns in the park that we have been removed and are stored safely somewhere.
A new five horn train whistle is mm-hmm. approximately $5,000 if you were to try to go buy it now. Do you have any idea what this particular unit might be worth in collector circles?
Well, it's, you know, it's hard to say what people will pay for it. I mean, I know one went on eBay last year there for about 6,000 Canadian. Just a brand new one, if you went down to CN today and had to replace a horn on an engine, it's about $5,000. So what one is worth amounted to the machine right behind us here that has all that history and the unique sound and everything. I mean, yeah, it's priceless.
That's park manager Brian Veek of the Prince George Railway and Forestry Museum, walking us through the significance of not just the missing Nathan M5 air chime horn, but three others that have also been stolen, along with some copper. This is Ian Gregg reporting from due north.
This is how we close our show this week. Thanks to our journalists, Erica Butler, Andrew Dow, Ian Gregg, and Jacob Postlewaite. Thanks to our national editors, Victoria Fenner and Conrad Fox. Viewpoints is brought to you by the Community Radio Fund of Canada and the Local Journalism Initiative. I'm Boris Chassaigne, your host and producer. Thanks to you for keeping us company this week, and until the next, ciao. Johnson in Toronto.